Hello, my name is Tony Reid. Welcome to JOY, a programme for LGBTI people and their friends on Coast Access Radio 104.7 FM and other access radio stations around New Zealand. Today I am repeating a programme I did about 10 years ago, so you probably won't remember it, but it doesn't date, and it's a rather amusing chapter from a book called Closet Queens, which is rather more serious than the title suggests. It's about 20th century British politicians who were either definitely gay or the author decides might have been. The author of the book is Michael Bloch, who is quite a well-known historian and biographer, most famous for writing the biography of Jeremy Thorpe, which I think inspired the TV series on that. And I'm reading one chapter from it, and it's called Bob and Tom. Bob Boothby, 1900 to 86, and Tom Dryburgh, 1905 to 76, were a pair of brilliant rogues, both in terms of their morals and in the sense of being completely one-off originals. Boothby sat as a Conservative MP for more than 30 years, Dryburgh as a Labour one for almost as long, but both were really independent politicians, who were generally regarded as thorns in the sides of their respective parties, though Boothby held minor office in two governments, while Dryburgh served as chairman of the Labour Party, a largely honorific position, in 1957-8. They had much in common apart from their shared sexual tastes. They were both outrageous risk-takers, in Boothby's case an addicted gambler, with a talent for getting out of scrapes. Although both professed egalitarian principles, they were tremendous hedonists who gorged themselves on life's luxuries, spending much of their lives in debt. Nor did their principles prevent them from revelling in the peerages which they brazenly asked for and duly received. Boothby becoming Baron Boothby of Bachan and Rattray Head, and Dryburgh Baron Bradwell of Bradwell Juxtamare. Towards the end of their lives, they both wrote fascinating autobiographies, Dryburgh's describing in lurid detail how he managed to combine a rackety queer sex life with successful careers in journalism and politics. Their backgrounds, although rather different, were both upper middle class. Boothby was the son of a well-connected Edinburgh businessman. After Eton and Oxford, he was at first destined for a legal career, but at 24 he was fortuitously adopted as Conservative candidate for the marginal seat of East Aberdeenshire, where he was returned with large majorities at 8 general elections, becoming immensely popular with his constituents. He was too impetuous and outspoken to be a successful party politician, but he could later claim to have been right on two important subjects. He saw that Keynesian economics provided a route out of the Depression, and he was one of Churchill's steadfast supporters in his campaign for rearmament in the 1930s. As we have seen, Churchill, as Chancellor in the 1920s, had taken a fancy to him and appointed him his PPS. But those supporting Churchill politically, Boothby did not warm to him personally. Certainly Churchill showed him little gratitude. After Boothby had played a key role in helping Churchill becoming Prime Minister in 1940, he was rewarded with a minor post as deputy to Lord Woolton at the Ministry of Food. And then a few months later, he was embroiled in the so-called Czech Assets affair, in which he failed to declare an interest when asking a parliamentary question. Churchill threw him to the wolves. Boothby's biography, Robert Rhodes James, argues that he paid a heavy price for a minor transgression, but clearly Boothby did not hesitate to cut corners in his business dealings. The stigma of the affair disqualified him from future government office, though after the war he became a huge celebrity on radio and television with his swaggering personality, arresting appearance and forthright opinions delivered in a gruff voice. Opinion polls suggested he was the nation's favourite politician, and his name was mooted by his friend Patrick Gordon Walker, Shadow Foreign Secretary in the early 1960s, as a possible future ambassador to France. I can certainly remember him. He was all over the telly in those days. Boothby, as a young man, was extremely good-looking and all his life possessed legendary seductive charm, had a powerful libido, and seems to have been sexually omnivorous. Rhode James insists that he was predominantly heterosexual, but a more recent biographer, John Pearson, maintains that his preference was always for teenage boys and young men. There was an incident in 1959 reported in the press when a 17-year-old constituent who had been visiting him in London was arrested in possession of his gold watch and chain. Boothby's heterosexual reputation rests largely on his affair with Lady Dorothy Macmillan, wife of the fellow Tory MP Harold Macmillan, which began in 1929 and continued, eventually assuming a platonic character, until her death in 1966. It was she who seduced Boothby and made the running throughout the affair. Boothby, while finding her passion exhausting, was undoubtedly fond of her. A rather masculine woman, she reminded him, as he confided to another raffish Tory politician, Tony Lambton, of a caddie he had once seduced on the golf links at St Andrews. Pearson suggested that the affair, which was common knowledge at Westminster, suited both Boothby and Macmillan. For Boothby, it was a convenient smokescreen for his homosexual activities, while Macmillan was relieved to see less of a demanding wife as he got on with his political career, which culminated in his attaining the premiership in 1957. Certainly, after some initial distress on Macmillan's part, the personal relations between the two men remained good, and Macmillan, as Prime Minister, was happy to nominate Boothby for the peerage he craved. Boothby married twice. His first wife, Diana Cavendish, was Dorothy Macmillan's cousin. According to Rhode James, he proposed to her when drunk and got cold feet at the prospect of marrying her that he spent the weeks before their wedding in 1935 in an alcoholic stupor. They lived together for barely a year before divorcing. His second wife, the Sardinian Wanda Senna, whom he married in 1967, was 33 years his junior and fulfilled a role as a companion and nursemaid during his later years. The marriage led to the immediate departure of Boothby's long-standing homosexual butler and confidant, Goodfellow. According to Rhode James, there were several other women he proposed to and then jilted. Apparently, he enjoyed the idea of married life, but shrunk from the reality. In his memoirs, Recollections of a Rebel, published in 1978, Boothby writes about homosexuality as a subject in which he takes a sympathetic interest, but which does not directly apply to him. He admits he was present with tempting opportunities, both as an Oxford undergraduate in the First World War and a visitor to Germany in the 1920s, but implies that he did not avail himself of these. He takes pride in the fact that through speechmaking and lobbying in the early 1950s, he helped bring about the appointment of the Wolfenden Committee, whose recommendations, including an age of consent of 21, he considers wholly admirable. I was thankful and slightly surprised when Parliament implemented them so quickly, after 10 years. He goes on to write, I have known many homosexuals in the course of my life in this country and abroad, and some of them are my friends. Down the centuries, they have played a large part in the development of Western civilization. As artists, they can depict and interpret emotion, perhaps better than anyone else, but in their own lives, they shrink from it. With rare exceptions, they are by nature promiscuous. Perhaps he was talking about himself. They like to pick each other up, casually in bars, clubs and Turkish baths. They enjoy sex in its cruder manifestations, but the enjoyment is transient. They don't believe in a past or a future. They live for the day and even for the hour. Many of them are attracted by the ritual of the church and by the personality of Jesus. No nonsense about family life there. But few of them are religious in depth. They call themselves gay, and so they are, for they are nearly always good company. But basically, they are not happy. Homosexuality is equally prevalent among what used to be called the higher and lower orders. But sometimes they are attracted to each other. This is known in homosexual circles as plain sewing. They are addicted to blackmail. It is because they have played, and always will, an important part in shaping all our lives that I have done and written so much about them. The trouble is that to a considerable extent, and much against my will, I share their general outlook on life. As we shall see, Boothby himself was attracted to the lower orders, and as a result had suffered from blackmail in the not-too-distant past. It is certainly the case that Boothby had homosexual friends. His greatest intimates include his fellow MPs Harold Nicholson and Malcolm Bullock. Not to mention Dryburgh, an example of a homosexual attracted to the ritual of the church. The same year as he published his memoirs, Boothby showed letters he had received from Nicholson to James Lees Milne, who was writing Nicholson's biography. Lees Milne wrote in his diary, "They disclosed that HN was homosexual. Lord Boothby remarked to me, I thought they disclosed that Boothby was homosexual too. Or HN would not have written to him recommending a harbour in Greece where pretty sailors were seen to be drinking and smoking." Rhode James goes along with Boothby's view of himself as an essentially heterosexual man, looking tolerantly down on the homosexual world. The frequent allegations that Boothby was a homosexual has been ridiculed by a considerable number of his friends, and particularly his women friends. Certainly his eye for women was not in any way deterred by any deviations he may have had with men. When he subsequently supported homosexual law reform, he was indignant that it was hinted he had a personal interest to declare. He was certainly not a congenital homosexual, unlike several of his friends, notably Harold Nicholson, Tom Dryburgh, Maurice Barra, Noel Coward and Somerset Maugham. But there was a homosexual strain as well, which surfaced from time to time, and which made him sensitive to the concerns and difficulties of what he called the buggers. Harold Nicholson is quite an interesting character in his own right, and I could make this programme far too long by going sideways and telling you more about him. We have already encountered Rhode James as the historian who, in his biography of Lord Rosebery, managed to say nothing about the widespread contemporary rumours that Rosebery was homosexual, and who also produced studies of other sexually ambiguous politicians while saying little or nothing about their queer side. Dryburgh was the youngest son of a retired member of the Indian Civil Service. His whole life was a reaction against the stifling bourgeois gentility of his upbringing in Crowborough, Sussex. During his school days at Lancing, where he befriended Evelyn Waugh and was influenced by the inspiring and homosexual master J.F. Roxburgh, later headmaster of Stowe, he acquired his lifelong passion for literature, left-wing socialism, High Anglican ritual and homosexuality. At Oxford, he was both an outrageous aesthete and dandy and an active member of the Communist Party, as well as becoming an acolyte of the Satanist Aleister Crowley. Leaving the university without a degree, Dryburgh hoped to make a career as a poet, like his friend Auden. Although the samples of his verse quoted by his biographer do not suggest much talent in this direction, his enthusiasms won him the patronage of Edith Sitwell, through whose influence he obtained a job as a gossip columnist on the Daily Express, a métier for which he proved to have considerable flair. During the 1930s, as a protégé for the paper's impish proprietor, Lord Beaverbrook, Dryburgh became famous through writing the submersive William Hickey column. He was paid a large salary, which went on good living. He was also recruited to MI5 by a clandestine homosexual and well-known occultist named Maxwell Knight, whose brief was to keep an eye on extremists of both left and right. It is not clear whether Dryburgh's role was to help identify Nazi sympathisers or betray fellow communists. But when in 1941 the comrades discovered, probably through Anthony Blunt, his Secret Service affiliations, he was expelled from the party. The following year, when the war was going badly and the government was unpopular, Dryburgh was elected to Parliament as an independent at a by-election at Maldon on the Essex coast. Before the outbreak of hostilities, he had bought a manor house in the constituency Bradwell Lodge, where he continued to live and entertain as an opulent squire. He subsequently joined the Labour Party, under whose colours he held Maldon until 1955, and then another Essex seat, Barking, from 1959 to 1974. As a celebrated left-winger, he was elected to the party's national executive in 1949, on which he remained for 23 years. In 1957, it was his turn to serve as chairman, in which role he made fraternal visits to Chairman Khrushchev. He seemed to have maintained connections with both the British and Soviet security services, though it is doubtful whether he passed on such information of value in either direction. He kept up his career in journalism as a columnist on the left-wing Sunday newspaper, Reynolds News, and had his great scoop in 1956 when he interviewed Guy Burgess in Moscow. While eloquently embracing left-wing causes, as well as the youth culture of the 1960s, Dreiberg revelled in Anglo-Catholic ritual, enjoyed the best food and drink, was snubbing to menials, unless they were desirable young men, and was a howling snob. His 70th birthday was notable for the presence of bishops and dukes. His notorious private life and radical views precluded him from public office. The job he most wanted, for which he begged Harold Wilson in vain, was that of Minister to the Vatican. But after retiring from the House of Commons, he was overjoyed to receive, thanks to his friend Michael Foot, a life peerage, taking his title from the country houses he had recently sold to clear his debts. Lord Bradwell lived for only 9 months to enjoy the House of Lords, though during that time he managed to embarrass the Labour government by advocating withdrawal from Northern Ireland and other radical measures. At his funeral, his coffin was draped with the red flag during a full Requiem Mass. During his brief sojourn in the Upper House, Dreiberg's fellow peers, particularly the not inconsiderable number who might be described as closet queens, were alarmed to hear that he was writing memoirs dealing frankly with his homosexuality. When these were published under the title Ruling Passions in 1977, a year after his death, it transpired that they were incomplete and had been heavily expurgated by lawyers. But enough remained to cause a sensation, for no autobiography of a public figure can ever have treated a raffish sex life so candidly or with such relish. Dreiberg revealed that his homosexual career had begun at the age of 3, when he inserted a finger into a hole in the trousers of his unsuspecting teenage brother and experienced an instant thrill. In his last year at Lancing, he was caught having an affair with a fellow pupil and only avoided disgrace thanks to an indulgent headmaster. This, however, was a rare example of Dreiberg being romantically involved with a member of his own class, for already on visits to Brighton he had acquired a taste for sex with strangers in public lavatories, which establishments, including the gents at the House of Commons, he was to haunt almost daily for his whole adult life. As he later told his friend Boothby, his ideal relationship was with a man he had never met before and would never meet again. His preference was for giving oral sex to handsome and basically heterosexual working-class youths. This, of course, involved great risks, but Dreiberg had a sixth sense for avoiding danger. He also became a master of the art of fellatio, given his partners much pleasure irrespective of their orientation. He was especially popular with the young sex-starved British servicemen he met in Cairo during the war, or reporting from Korea in the 1950s, or visiting Cyprus as a political observer in the 1960s, they positively queued up for his services. He was a fast operator. If he fancied a waiter on a train or a sailor in a pub, it usually took him just a moment to connect and disappear with the object of his desire, as astonished witnesses to these disappearing acts later informed his biographer. Sometimes the most unlikely people succumbed to his advances, such as the great Labour politician and Nyrin Bevin when they were alone after a few drinks. Inevitably, Dreiberg's activities sometimes landed him in tight spots from which he showed skill in extricating himself. Once during the war, he was caught by a policeman fellating a Norwegian sailor in an air raid shelter. He not only persuaded the officer to ignore the incident, but subsequently had a friendly correspondence with him on literary subjects, an episode used by Compton Mackenzie in his novel Thin Ice. He was also an expert at bribing policemen, as he assured Tony Crossland and Roy Jenkins, with whom he shared a regular illegal canasta game in the House of Commons in the late 1940s. Only once in 1935 was he charged with an indecent assault, after two Scottish coal miners he had invited to his house complained to the police. On that occasion, he was saved by Beaverbrook, who paid the costs of his successful defence and ensured that no mention of the case appeared in the press. Though Dryburgh's proclivities were notorious in the circles in which he moved, he was sufficiently mindful of his reputation to get married in 1951, much to the astonishment of all who knew him. The humorist Osbert Lancaster wrote a wedding ode in which the inquiry as to just impediment or cause was followed by an awkward pause. His bride, Ina Binfield, was a Jewish divorcee 2 years older than himself and an active member of the Labour Party. She thought she had fallen in love with him, knew about his inclinations, and seemed happy to marry him on the understanding that she would make no sexual demands. Presumably, he acquired a wife for political reasons, to help him hang on to his marginal seat, and in the hope of office at a time when his party was still in power. The marriage was not a success. He conceived an intense loathing for her on their honeymoon and behaved to her with sadistic cruelty for the next 25 years while contriving to see as little of her as possible, though they never divorced or formally separated. She was evidently a glutton for punishment, for despite this treatment, she did all she could to support him, not just performing those duties expected of an MP's wife, but attempting to manage his chaotic finances and slaving as his housekeeper at Bradwell Lodge. During the 1960s, both Boothby and Dryburgh, no doubt feeling they could get away with anything, indulged a taste for rough trade from the criminal underworld. Boothby had an affair with a pretty young cat burglar called Leslie Holt, sometimes letting him know which peers were away on holiday, whose residences Holt would then burgle, sharing the proceeds with Boothby. Dryburgh befriended an armed robber named Steve Raymond. Once when Raymond's gang were doing a big job, Raymond provided him with an alibi for arranging to spend part of the evening at the Gay Hussar restaurant with Dryburgh, who was dining there with the Solicitor General, his old friend Sir Dingle Foot. Early in 1964, the government chief whip, Martin Redmayne, learnt from a reliable source that Boothby and Dryburgh had been seen together hobnobbing with young criminal types at the White City dog track. Public records released in 1995 show that this news, coming just months after the Conservative government had been rocked by the Profumo scandal, led to anxious consultations involving the Home Secretary and Prime Minister. Meanwhile, Boothby and Dryburgh had made the acquaintance of the Cray twins, homosexual East End gangsters. I don't think that's entirely true, actually. One of the twins was gay. I don't think the other one was. As a result of visiting a West End gambling club, the twins had acquired Esmeralda's barn. The Crays ran an escort service of handsome youths, mostly their own lovers, for the benefit of customers who might be useful to them, of which both Boothby and Dryburgh took advantage. It was thus that Boothby met Holt. Though the twins at 31 were too old to interest him sexually, Boothby seems to have enjoyed their company. He entertained them at the House of Lords and White's Club and accepted their invitations to West End restaurants and their Walthamstow flat. It was not long before the twins were seeking favours from Boothby, asking if he would lend his name to a proposed business venture, in fact a scam, in West Africa. They visited him at his flat in Eaton Place to discuss the matter, where they were photographed with him. Somehow the photograph fell into the hands of the Sunday Mirror, whose chairman Cecil King was out to curry favour with the Labour Party, which was expected to return to power at the general election due within a few months. In July 1964, the paper ran a sensational story to the effect that a well-known Tory peer was on intimate terms with gangsters who were being investigated by the police. Having been identified as the peer in the foreign press, Boothby at first contemplated suicide, but then learnt that the Mirror story was alarming not just to the Conservative government, but also to the Labour opposition, as it risked leading to the public exposure of their ex-chairman Tom Dryburgh, possibly Redmayne, having learnt some months previously that Boothby and Dryburgh hunted as a pair, had hinted to his Labour opposite number that if Boothby became a cropper, Dryburgh would too. Acting on the advice of Arnold Goodman, solicitor and friend of the Labour leader Harold Wilson, Boothby issued a public statement declaring that he had never been a homosexual and had never met the Crays except on business, and denouncing the Mirror story as a tissue of atrocious lies. The story was, of course, essentially true, while Boothby's statement was mostly lies. He then began libel proceedings against the newspaper, which settled the case by offering Boothby an unqualified apology and paying him the enormous sum of £40,000, equal to at least £1 million in the values of 50 years later. The money may have been well spent. A Dryburgh scandal might have cost Wilson the election, which he won that October with a majority of just 4 seats. The episode, however, had a baleful effect on public life, as it encouraged politicians who had something to hide to believe that they could get away with anything if they stuck to stout denial. It is interesting that a great friend of Boothby who regarded him as a role model was Jeremy Thorpe. It also helped the Crays evade justice, for if Boothby had been exonerated by the Mirror apology, so to some extent had they. Moreover, they proceeded to blackmail Boothby when in 1966 they were tried at the Old Bailey for demanding money with menaces. They extracted funds from him with which they used to pay the cost of their defence and of the bribery and intimidation of jurors and witnesses which secured their acquittal, enabling them to continue their increasingly violent criminal career for another 2.5 years. Around the time of his second marriage in 1967, which represented escape from a way of life that had become nightmarish and was intensifying his alcoholism, Boothby told Dryburgh that his libel windfall had all gone. "Which he was wise to say," Dryburgh remarked to a friend, "otherwise I might have tapped him." When Boothby received his apology from the Mirror, he was showered with congratulations, not just from political friends such as Michael Foot, but from editors of other newspapers who, without any hint of irony, wrote approvingly in their columns of the stand he had taken. His biographer Rhodes James also described the episode as just reparation for a monstrous slur. If one compares this with the sceptical hilarity which greeted Dryburgh's marriage a decade earlier, one can see that for all the similarity between the two men, there was an important difference. Whereas Dryburgh's proclivities were common knowledge in the circles in which he moved, Boothby, for the most part, managed to keep his homosexual life secret from all but a few like-minded friends. Indeed, but for Boothby's reputation as a red-blooded heterosexual who was conducting an open affair with the wife of a cabinet minister, it is unlikely that he would have influenced the homophobic Maxwell Fyfe, the Home Secretary of the day, to set up the Wolfenden Committee in 1954. The fact that Boothby and Dryburgh survived and flourished is a tribute to their diplomatic skills, and it is perhaps a pity that they were frustrated in their hopes of becoming Her Majesty's representatives in Paris and the Vatican. So there we have it, Bob and Tom, a couple of very interesting characters, and I'm sorry there are so many names in there that you probably won't have heard of, so you might want to spend an afternoon with Google. Of course, you'll find some quite interesting, because the same people. Harold Nicholson's name crops up in almost every political biography I've got of the 20th century. But it's all very interesting, and he does note that Boothby's influence in getting the Wolfenden Committee set up was a major event, and we can be grateful to him for that. At least, even if being friendly with the Cray twins was not the perhaps the most advisable thing.
This programme was made with assistance from New Zealand On Air for radio broadcast and through the accessmedia.nz website. Thank you, New Zealand On Air.